This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm your NBN host, Lavinia Stan, a professor of political science at St. Francis Xavier University in Canada. I am talking today with Dr. Jan Selling, a professor of history and head of the Department of Critical Romani Studies at Södertörn University in Stockholm, Sweden. Welcome to New Books Network, Jan.
Thank you so much, Lavinia.
Thank you for accepting this interview about your recent book, Romani Liberation, A Northern Perspective on Emancipatory Struggles and Progress, which was published with Central European University Press in 2022. Before we turn to the Romani Liberation, could you tell us and our listeners a bit about your academic journey, please?
Okay. Well, let me start like this. As I was a young student, I went to Berlin in 1992. Well, that was a mind-blowing experience to me. I was amazed about all the culture, politics, and history in that city. And then after almost 15 years of studying German historical memory and also living a decade in Berlin, where history and memory is everywhere, and where history is also so barbaric and traumatic and politicized, I needed a break. So I moved back to Sweden and I finished my PhD in history at Lund University. So, and what was my break? Well, it was my chill out as a historian. I did oral history about archipelago fishermen and women in the new environment in Sweden where I was now living. So again, it was my physical surrounding which shaped my scope of writing at that time. I wrote two books about fish and then I felt ready again. Luckily, I was then recruited by Uppsala University to build up the field of anti-gypsyism studies in Sweden, which was non-existent at the time. And, well, apparently I did a good job. And perhaps there was also a political momentum for bringing anti-gypsyism on the table. Anyhow, I was then again headhunted into something new to me. This time it was by the Central Council of German Sinti and Roma in Heidelberg, Germany. And they invited me to a large European project with the ambitious goal to build counter-narratives as tools for decolonizing Romani studies, which I must say this field of Romani studies, it is still today extremely dominated by exotifying and essentialist perspectives, what we call gypsy lorism. So what we did in this big project was to conduct empirical research in many areas and geographic settings. We were a large team of more than 20 scholars, and we built a multifaceted knowledge platform, which is accessible on the internet as romarchive.eu. This was very much a Roma-run project, and I felt humbled to be part of it. This gave me confidence to start mapping and discuss Roma political perspectives and Roma agency in history, because I never wanted to be that white European male who pretends to know Roma better than themselves, to quote Roma professor Ian Hancock. I am a white European male, but I have to be self-critical about my role. So that's why I, for years, had felt that my place was simply to analyze the anti-Gypsyism or major society. And again, going deep into that dark side for years, that gets on my stomach. So suddenly, through the Rome Archive Project, I, for the first time, had the possibility to reflect philosophy of history with Roma academics. Of course, I had already many contacts with the Swedish Roma community and also Roma students in Sweden, but here it was top academic level. I realized that it's not just about my stomach, but that there is something fundamentally wrong and inaccurate when the history of a people is written solely through the lens of victimization, portraying as victims. That is one-sided and also a form of othering, a way of producing hopelessness. Also, the main narratives on Roma history have rarely produced biographies of actual persons and personalities, nor have they told the story about Roma agency, Roma shaping their fate, their way through history. So to put it short, I wanted now, with this Romani liberation, to write an accessible, comprehensive book on Roma history, which gives hope. Secondly, I wanted to, as much as possible, to have Romani voices and perspectives represented. So this is my story, how I ended up in this project of Romani liberation.
Thank you. This is a fascinating life story, if you think about it. Yeah, you are the first Swede who is invited to build up this new field in at Uppsala University, and you are so passionate about it that you are carrying the good work in other universities, including now at Södertörn University, where you are teaching. Now, let me raise a very basic question. Who are the Roma?
Well, I think the most neutral and simple answer to this is to say that Roma is an umbrella term for many different groups and communities who all have historical links to the Romani language group and who identify with a Romani cultural heritage. Finito.
Uh-huh. Having grown up in Romania, I remember that the Roma in that country include a lot of groups. Some of them are defining themselves by their occupation. Some of them are defining themselves by other. But it's a very pluralistic and very diverse group of people.
Yes, so, definitely.
And I just for our listeners and for people like me who don't necessarily know that much about the Roma community in Nordic countries, including Sweden, how big is the Roma community in Sweden? In the thousands, in the hundreds, how big is in Nordic countries?
Well, we have only estimates, of course, because there is officially no registration of this, but the most accurate estimations lay around maybe 100,000, 100,000 Roma, representing many different groups. We have like 27 dialects in Sweden. And I will get back to that maybe
later. Okay. The book has been published as part of the Critical Romani Studies series. Could you tell us, our listeners, what is this series all about? What does Critical Romani Studies mean? You mentioned a little bit the difference with Gypsy lore, but could you expand on this idea?
Well, this book series—it's the aim is to bring together a new sort of a new strand in scholarship, which represents this what we call Romani studies, and we are some are Romani scholars and some are not Romani scholars, but we are in critical Romani studies. So, and if I just mention the titles of the ones, you get an impression what's the thing. So, besides my book, which is called Romani Liberation, as we said, there's another book by Katerina Dunayeva called Constructing Identities Over Time. And the third book is called Mobilizing Romani Ethnicity by Anna Mirga Krishelnika. So it is about liberation, identity, critically reflecting Roma ethnicity, identity, belonging. And we may... And as for what is critical Romani studies, well, there has been just as in other fields, there was the talk about the linguistic turn. In the field of Romani studies, we have since maybe a decade, there is the talk about the critical turn. And this word critical, it is referring to critical theory, meaning that academic knowledge is not just entertainment or confirming circumstances in society, but it's something which contributes to define and critically analyze the power relationships in society. And this is, I mean, in the case of classical Romani studies, or as some still call it, Gypsy studies or Gypsyology. Well, some Germans even call it Ziganologie, which is a very ugly word. This has been locked into an Orientalist paradigm, which essentializes perspectives on Roma as exotic and antisocial outsiders. So the scholars have sort of defined the people and locked them into this identity and this image. So the critical Romani studies aims at questioning this, in fact, quite racist approach and search for the cracks in this anti-Gypsist hegemony. And this field of critical Romani studies has a strong focus on opening up knowledge production and higher education for Roma.
Well said. Let's now turn to your recent book on Romani liberation and start by reminding our listeners why we are talking about liberation and why your study provides a northern perspective on it.
Well, there are two main dimensions in my book, Liberation and Emancipation. So the story of Romani emancipation has to do with achieving the same formal rights as everybody else in society. But liberation goes further. And I, in my introduction, relate to the French philosopher Henri Lefebvre, who claimed that emancipation is a necessary first step on the way to liberation, because liberation that includes also the existential dimension where humans can realize their full potential. And this concept of liberation is also a central component of the pedagogical traditions linked to Paulo Freire, which was influential in South America in the 60s and 70s, mainly to combat injustice in society through scholarship. And according to Paulo Freire, awareness rising is the first step in any group struggle to achieve social justice. And my geographical focus, the Nordic perspective, my focus is on the countries I have the most relationship to. It's as simple as that. And also have access to the languages, which is important for a researcher, I think. And in the Rome Archive, this knowledge platform I mentioned before, I curated the research on the Nordic countries and on Germany and on Austria. So I had strong insights in that. And this starting point has, of course, influenced what questions I ask and the way I compose the international narrative. So that's the Nordic perspective, I would say.
But would you say that Romani liberation in any way has specific attributes in Northern European countries as opposed to some other countries on the continent? Do you think that Romani liberation entails more struggle or more effort in Eastern Europe, for example, than in Nordic Scandinavian countries? Is there anything in which the geography, the geographical focus of your analysis kind of points to a particular specificity of this liberation to the northern area of the continent?
Well, that's a tricky question, of course. But well, obviously, one main perspective. I'm a historian, and I am specialized in historical memory and what I call historical justice. And this is again also referring to the approach by German philosopher Theodor V. Adorno. Confronting the past means that we have to change the society now, otherwise it's just entertainment. The way this historical justice approach has worked in the Nordics has something in common, and structurally also something in common actually with the Germany-Austria, even though Germany-Austria is so strongly linked to the Holocaust, whereas in the Scandinavian context we're talking about forced sterilizations, forced assimilations within, at least in the Swedish case, throughout democratic society. So this is something where which is something here in common, and I think I hope that it sheds light also on other geographic contexts. And I do discuss, of course, some East European countries and France and England and so forth, and. But of course, the contexts are very different. To put it short, I would say that anti-Gypsyism is surprisingly homogeneous throughout the time, since the Middle Ages up to today, and geographically through over, at least the Western.
Across the continent. Yes. Across the continent, yes.
Yes, but talking about Roma culture, ethnicities, this is something very dynamic and anti-Gypsyism is not dynamic in that it adapts itself, but it is stereotypical. That's why it is anti-Gypsyism. So I think there is a common thread which is relevant for discussing also other areas, which obviously also happens. We have exchange among researchers. We had last year a project called ChachiPen, where you actually were also part, talking about transitional justice, comparing contexts and methods. We had Sweden and Germany on the one end, and we had Romania and Spain on the other, that it has, to what extent can we exchange this? And in order to do that, I think it's necessary to have this wide overview. So we will get back to that more in detail, I hope, in the talk. But so this is why I don't just do one case study, because I have my focus, my perspective. I cannot escape that, but I discuss global perspectives.
Very good. What kind of materials did you use while you prepared your book on Romani liberation?
Well, let me put it like this. The bulk of knowledge, because that was very much gathered by the Rome Archive team where I was part of that collective, that was never systematically analyzed in that project. So that was my first aim. That was my starting point, all this material. With the tools of grounded theory, to see where are the patterns and coincidences in this whole material, and discourse analysis, what kind of what reoccurs in different contexts, and then I saw what kind of analytical questions how can I systemize this? How can I sort of sketch out some narrative or something? And then I saw where there were gaps in the geographies and contexts I manage. I was adding new desk research to this. And so I aimed at building, firstly, a grounded, coherent narrative, which is, in a way, global, which I do in the beginning of the book. And by doing this, I identified also which analytical tools I find most relevant for doing this as a historian. So that is what I discussed in the other chapters. It's about epistemology, the conditions of knowledge production, the hegemony of gypsy lorism, as we talked about, or in another way, word, academic anti-gypsyism, you might also call it, which I analyze through critical historiography methods. And since I am a historian of collective memory, I applied also this concept of historical justice, which we also mentioned. And this is specifically important to my book, This Historical Justice, because this I show that this has been and is an arena for challenging the role of Romas in society, confronting the past as a driver of social change. It is very evident in Germany especially, but also in some Nordic contexts. And in this, I was interested in relating Roma experiences from different historic and geographic contexts to each other. So how come that in Sweden and Finland, the Romas went on the streets in the 60s, whereas in Germany, it happened more in the 80s, and similar things, but in different, like this.
The book is divided into two main parts. The first part provides a historical perspective, as you anticipated, whereas the second part talks about the Swedish experience. Let's walk our listeners through the first part. Talk about each chapter and what summarize its main idea.
Hmm. Okay. In the first opening part, which I call The Long Road to Liberation, I offer a concise international historical narrative in less than 50 pages. And that's important to me. It should be able to read on a long train ride. You have this. It shows that it by no means has been a one-way road. This is absolutely not what I'm saying. And also, we are by no means by the end of that history. It is a focus on Roma agency. The second chapter is more thematic and analytical. Here I introduce the concept of historical justice, which, as I said, is a key for understanding the connection between historical injustice, collective memory, and the anti-Gypsyism which we have still around us, and connecting all of this to Romani activism. This relates very well to this German philosopher Theodor Adorno. And this explains why it is important and why it's so powerful for giving energy into civil rights movements. The third chapter is perhaps the most important in a way in the book. It's called Decolonizing Romani Studies, and it critically discusses the role of this influential British American Academic Association, Gypsy Law Society, which was founded in Victorian England in the 19th century, but still is very much around and very dominant in scholarship, and how this has been crucial for establishing and defending this Orientalist paradigm of the field. So what I did was then to, by means of a critical historiography, I tried to point out tendencies in scholarly and non-scholarly literature in the field. That was the one part. The other part was that I was also bringing this in conversation with some previously unpublished documents of the Gypsy Law Society of the recent decades. So where it was, it evolved a discussion whether this Gypsy Law Society should feel any responsibility for the racism it has produced, and they refuted this, of course, which I sketch out why that is problematic. So through this, I position this so-called critical turn, the emergence of Romani scholarship, but also of Romani authors, how this sort of change the scene. And I also offer a detailed theoretical discussion on how to understand different dimensions of anti-Gypsyism. And the concluding parts, they return to my initial questions, such as what are the main obstacles for Romani liberation and what would be the conditions for progress? Which was actually also the title of my first book in 2013 in Swedish, where that was the subtitle there. So what are the obstacles and what are the conditions for progress? And in this, I also use Sweden as a detailed case study. To put it short, we cannot understand Romani history without understanding anti-Gypsyism. And secondly, nationalism has always been the worst political climate for Roma, and that the openings, the cracks in this wall, they have occurred firstly in historical occasions where the interests of Roma have coincided with the interest of larger society. And this is what theorists Chang have called, for example, interest convergence. And the second explanation I offer is it also has occurred in situations where expectations, growing expectations, have become frustrated, such as during the rise of the Swedish Roma rights movements in the 1960s, where a lot of promises were set up by society politics, and nothing happened, nothing improved, or it improved, but too slowly. So when things start to get a bit better, you want them to be much better, and at least that the promises are kept, yeah? And this is something which I think is relevant for many other contexts as well. Why do people make revolutions? That's about it. And maybe to mention a name which is very familiar here, but in other countries not. This Swedish Roma rights movement in the 60s was also became an icon in the famous Romani writer Katarina Taikon.
So you told us about the information you included in your book, but how is the experience of the Roma, not only in Sweden, in the other Nordic countries, Norway, Finland, Denmark? And how are the numbers similar of the Romani communities in these countries, similar to Sweden, I mean? Give us a broad idea for listeners who don't know anything about the subject.
Don't quote me on the numbers here, but if I said like approximately 100,000 in Sweden, maybe 10,000 in Finland, Norway, and Denmark, even less. So it is actually very different in these Nordic countries. And for two reasons, the situation. The first reason is, of course, the positions of the countries during the Second World War. Norway was occupied by Nazi Germany. Finland was partly allied with Nazi Germany. And Sweden, as the pretended neutral, who, as we know, for a long time was on best terms with Nazi Germany in general. And in this area was also, it's important to say, a main producer of biological racism. The world's first institute for racial biology in Uppsala, which was frequently visited by German scholars, of course. But also that Sweden during the war closed the borders explicitly against Roma refugees. So these are some contexts. And the second context is what we also mentioned before. It has to do with the composition of the Romani communities, which is very, very different in the Nordic countries. On the one hand, in Finland, there is almost only one Roma group, the Kale. On the other hand, we have Norway, where the largest Romani group, the Norwegian travelers, is not even defined as Roma officially, and also don't self-define as Roma, but it is Romani group. And then in Norway, we also have a very small and very narrowly defined group of Norwegian Roma. But this is something political. There are also other Roma from the Balkans also, who are not included. But anyway, we have very different. So in the middle, we have Sweden, which has the largest and also most diverse Roma community. And Denmark then is a very special case, which I actually don't hardly discuss in my book, but because it refuses to recognize Roma as a national minority at all. And this is unusual in Europe. Despite the historical and present day existence of this minority in Denmark, there is evidence that it should be acknowledged, but Denmark simply doesn't do it. And it's also interesting to see that in Denmark has the most anti-Gypsy attitudes in attitude surveys of all Nordic countries. Maybe it's a coincidence, but that's the case. So it is different.
So just to clarify, is the Nordic experience different from the rest of the continent? You already touched on this question, but do you want to add anything else? Is it my impression that Romani groups in Scandinavia are usually rooted in Eastern European Romani who took refuge in Scandinavia at some point in time, or is this not true?
Well, as I said, it has a very it's very heterogeneous group. There is the perhaps largest group within the Roma collective. It's the Romani, Swedish travelers, some would say. They themselves call the Resande. That's a very large group, and they are established in Sweden for centuries, dated until the 16th century. So that's something different. And then, of course, since Sweden and Finland has a common history, it was one country for a while. And there also has always been Finnish Roma in Sweden, obviously. But then you're in a way right there that since the 1990s, the wars in Yugoslavia, a lot of refugees, Roma refugees, have come to Sweden. And also a large majority of them are Muslims. It should also be said that many of these, the second generation from this, they have been very, very successful, study at universities and everything. And so that's one thing. But the other, is Nordic experience so different from the rest of the continent? Well, we often think that. And you foreign academics, you tend to make fun of us Nordic exceptionalism, and what this does to our self-perception. We are always so special, more moral than everybody else, and more modern and equal and everything. And, well, in fact, I think that there is something special. And I think that has to do with the homogeneous self-image, which was, in fact, very destructive then, but also with a total historical dominance of Protestant churches, and with the dominance of social democratic welfare ideology. It's a very secular country. And perhaps also we could add that there is an outspoken consensus culture. We don't argue openly about things in Sweden. So there are some things I would say is special or...
Well, I think in political science, at least, many political scientists in North America, excuse me, would argue that Scandinavia is one of the most democratic regions of Europe. So it has this benefit of having implemented democratic institutions and democratic norms for many more decades than, for example, Eastern Europe, or a country like Greece that was rocked by the colonel's dictatorship. So in this respect, some North American political scientists would argue that Scandinavia is well ahead some other regions of Europe, and its experience in protecting minorities or failing to protect minorities, yeah, is like a lesson that could be offered to newer democracies in Central and Eastern Europe, for example, you know.
Yeah, that's an observation, which is, I was actually thinking of. Let's say, because that's a kind of a thing which people always ask me. Which country at which time was the best for Roma to live in, or something like that? And this is a bit related to this. Let's put it as a mind game. Because this is a hard question and you cannot generalize, but with some reservations, as I said, Yugoslavia during Titoism in the 1970s is very, very interesting. And as I said, there is something about it that the second generation or the children of the refugees who came from the Balkans in the 90s, that they are so often so successful. There's something, that's an indication. So that talking about the Nordic, and yes, it has a good setting for doing something positive here. In a way, Germany as well, but Germany has also a terrible, the most terrible past of every country. But I think, especially in the North, there is a pretty clear-cut political concept of how to create a society which respects everybody, and it has good intentions and a social system with traditions of human rights and material equality. Also, those are rich countries, so we can afford this. We could afford, I would say. So, and I think it's no coincidence that Sweden and Germany, I mean, Germany for maybe for different reasons, but those were the two first to have expert commissions on anti-Gypsyism. And at times, of course, we can question the good intentions. And they are maybe right now also a bit under attack because the right-wing populism is advancing as everywhere, also here. So it's no more as we are talking about, a longer perspective, and there it's justified to put it like that. But still, I would not say that everything is gone just because we have a right-wing populist backlash now, because there are still useful and good legal texts to refer to, and there are discourses and knowledge which people can use and fight for. So it's some sort of almost a hegemony of this kind of civil rights thinking in a way. Yeah, so that was a long answer to that question.
No, that was very interesting and a very, very nice addition to your argument. The book includes a foreword signed by Nicoleta Bitu and afterwards written by Soraya Post and Hans Kaldarash. Why was it important for you to include their testimonials, their texts?
Well, first of all, those three persons who are all Roma, actually, they have been my mentors for many years in this. But also they contribute with perspectives and experiences which I simply don't have and cannot have. So I was extremely happy that they wanted to write. And they write a bit about different things because of their roles. Soraya Post, she was in European Parliament, and she was certainly a driver for the European recognition of anti-Gypsyism this kind of process. So she writes, maybe not very optimistic, but she writes about what still was done and could be done at the political level. Hans Kaldaras, he writes about the people who are most disrespected among Roma. When we're talking about Swedish societies, and those are some people who, because of their racialized poverty and racism in Romania, go to Scandinavian countries, sit on the street with a paper cup and beg for help. And he makes us understand. And because he talks to those persons, and so that's his perspective. And then he relates this to his own childhood, because he was one of the generations, maybe one of the last of the generations of Swedish Roma who had to live in tents in Sweden, who were completely excluded from society. So he relates this. The terrible conditions when it's snowing, you have to sleep outside, the fear for the police, the fear for racist attacks. So he writes about that level from a very personal perspective. And Nicoletta Bitu, she writes about from the perspective of being a major, very important Romani feminist intellectual who has seen the different waves of Romani activisms and the progress and the backlashes but she has a very hopeful foreword. So I'm very happy to have that there. So that gives hope, and that was my intention with the whole book. So thank you, Nicoletta Bitu.
If you were to change anything to the book, what would that be? Would you delete the chapter? Would you add some information? Would you add new cases or new historical perspectives? What would it be?
Well, I'm not the kind of person who does things like that, and also my answer is no, I wouldn't really change anything. Of course, the book doesn't cover all countries and all aspects, and it doesn't provide a new grand theory of social mobilization. That was not my aim. So still, no, I wouldn't really change. My point was, as I said, to provide an accessible book, and I already had quite a few comments that they appreciate this and read it as such, and I'm happy to do that. And I wanted also to offer a more or less coherent narrative. This is the trajectory of Romani liberation. You can, of course, tell it in other ways, but this is one way of telling it, and there are not so many. And also I wanted to offer some tools for critically dealing with Romani history and anti-Gypsyism, if you want to go deeper into it. So it's like a book with different layers. You can read it like more accessible to have a sort of an idea about this, but you can also go deep into it and use it for going deeper into things. So I mean, it's an invitation for other researchers to work out the many and wide gaps, and I hope that many of these historians will be Roma.
And I can testify, having read the book, that it's a very engaging reading, full of information, full of academic perspectives, but also full of factual details that are that could be seen as a starting point for further conversations on Roma liberations, not only in northern countries, but also in other parts of the world. Is there, based on your experience or based on all the information you collected to date, is there a country that could be seen as a model in terms of the treatment of the Roma people?
Yeah, I think we were, in a way, we were into that question. And I think really, I mean, there are different, I talk about early periods of emancipation. And one of the earliest periods is in the Ottoman Empire. In some parts of it were already in the 13th century, Romani were settled and asked for artisans and, so comparatively, that was certainly better off there than in Northern Europe, where it was severe persecution at the time, and of course better off than in the Ottoman vassal states of Wallachia. So that was something. And then we have the emancipation from slavery. That did not turn out very well in Romania, I must say. We can get back to that. In the early Soviet Union is also one interesting part of the minority politics where self-organizing and schools and alphabet, Romanes alphabet was promoted very much. It was then stopped, of course. And then again, as I said, Titoism during the 70s. Going back to the question, I should maybe have expanded on a chapter or maybe at least a little more about that, what was about it, because it's not so one-sided, but there is something interesting about that.
Jan, we have so many positive examples what I call models of in terms of the treatment of the Roma people. But what is the main obstacle for Romani liberation in the other countries, in the other time periods? How can these obstacles be overcome?
Well, I think, I mean, one interesting observation is that Yugoslavia and the early Soviet Union, those were the only two communist countries which were not based on a nationalism in that sense. They were, per definition, multi. Now, this is why, and only the only reason why this kind of interesting, partly emancipation projects could happen there. So, well, nationalism has never been good for Romani liberation. We see this very clearly at the end of the Ottoman Empire. It splitted, and then anti-Gypsies increased. Everybody was picking team and nobody wanted to have the Roma on the team. And also again in the 90s in Yugoslavia, Kosovo, nationalism is the most terrible option. But and again, we see also in this right-wing populism, nationalism is of course a component of that. But within this, as an overall problem, as Soraya Post has written in her reports for the European problem, the root cause for discrimination, exclusion, prejudice, and violence against Roma is anti-Gypsyism. So this is it. And how can it be overcome? Well, a first step is to change this, is to recognize it as a problem. A second step is to establish a political will. But political will is, of course, a highly unstable factor. So I again would quote Ian Hancock and say, education is the passport to freedom. Because the more high-educated Roma we get, the more the conversation will change.
That's well said. Now, I see that you are speaking with so much passion about Roma and Romani liberation, and I just guess that you will continue somehow to study these issues. What is your current project? And it is related somehow to your work done to date.
Definitely. I am right now, since a year, involved in a historical project called Memorabilia, which analyzes the legacy of 500 years of Roma enslavement in Wallachia and Moldova, which is now part of Romania, and how this memory is being suppressed in today's Romania, because it's astonishing and appalling to which degree this is not talked about and educated about. So why is this? That's my research question there. And my specific task is to analyze the discourses of the Orthodox Church and in academia. So, we were there on a field study with the team. And since I am the only white male person with a beard, I had the task to interview priests and other Orthodox church people. And I cannot talk about the results, but I can just say so much that it was very interesting, partly surprising, partly shocking, very interesting material. So I think this study, together with the other researchers, which are Magda Matake from Harvard, Solvo Lauritsen from MF, and Delia Grigore from Bucharest University, it is a very important and exciting project. And then the other main part of my work, I am teaching a lot, too much, I would say. My work there is to sort of consolidate the academic spaces for critical Romani studies. And my specific interest is to promote upcoming Romani scholars. I have an international colloquium for PhD candidates in critical Romani studies online, so everybody's welcome to join or apply for it. So in the true sense of critical theory, I don't just want to describe the world, but to do something about the conditions for knowledge production in this field.
And I wish you all the best in your future studies and your future activities. Our guest today at New Books Network was Dr. Jan Selling, the author of Romani Liberation, A Northern Perspective on Emancipation, Struggles and Progress, a book published with Central European University Press in 2022. Thank you, and hope we'll talk again soon about your projects. Goodbye.